Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a friend of Sarah Connor. I was told that she's here. Could I see her, please?
No, can't see her. She's making a statement.
Where is she?
Look, it may take a while. You want to wait? There's a bench over there.
I'll be back.
Just tell me one thing, Burke. You're going out there to destroy them, right? Not to study, not to bring back, but to wipe them out.
That's the plan.
Movement! Talk to me, Hudson!
I got signals, I got readings in front and behind.
There's nothing back here.
Look, I'm telling you, there's something moving and it ain't us.
Get them out of there!
All right.
Here. You put this on.
No, what are you going to do?
Don't argue with
me,
but just put it on.
No, look, this is not an option, so just forget about it, all right?
Shut up! No. Shut up! Put this thing on.
You be logical for one second,
please. Logic!
Just listen to me for one second. Now, you've got the suit on, and you're a much better swimmer than I am, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Right? Yes. So I've got a plan.
What's the plan?
I drowned, and you throw me back to the rig.
No. No.
Yes, just water.
No.
Only a couple of degrees above freezing. Like, going to deep hypothermia. My blood will go like ice water. Right? My body systems will slow down. They won't stop.
Then,
you told me back and I can be revived after maybe 10 or 15 minutes.
Lynn, put this on.
Minutes.
You put it on.
That's the only way. You just put this on. Put this on, you know, right? Please. It's the only way you've got on. I'm not ready to do this. Put this on. But please.
This is insane.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
The only way. No.
I'm sorry, John. I'm sorry.
No, it'll be okay. Stay with us. It'll be okay.
I have to go away.
No, don't do it. Please, don't go.
I must go away, John.
No! No, wait. Wait, you don't have to do this.
I'm sorry.
No, don't do it. Don't go.
It has to end here.
I order you not to go.
I know now why you cry. But it's something I can never do.
How'd it go at the convention, honey?
You were the big hit of the show.
It's fantastic.
I love the computer business.
For 15 years, Harry Tasker's been leading a double life.
Mr. President, one of our best men is inside.
Transmitting now.
Right on time.
I don't believe I've met you before.
Rehnquist. Harry Rehnquist.
Listen to the following code word. Helen. H-E-L-E-N.
Now, they're about to collide.
What's your exit strategy?
I'm going to walk right out of this front gate.
May I see your invitation, please?
Sure. Here's my invitation.
Shit, there's only so many places she can be. Find her.
Iceberg waters!
I have been robbed.
Is this it?
Don't you believe it, Rose?
Rose! Don't you understand? The water is freezing and there aren't enough boats. People on the ship are going to die.
I'm the better half.
Are you doing money?
When I finish putting first-class people on the boat, they'll be struggling with us.
Roll away!
Why are the boats being lost half full?
For God's sake, there's little children down here! Get us out so we can have a chance!
Where are you going? What's him?
To gain their trust.
You should not be here. Go back. All this is your fault.
I need your help.
Outstanding.
about 1 hour.
You knew this would happen?
Everything changed. Jake, it's crazy here. Poor Rich is rolling and there's no stopping him.
We're going up against gunships with bows and arrows.
Well, I guess we better stop him.
An epic opening for an epic show. Hope everyone out there is having a great night. This is Movie Geeks United, and my name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry, and welcome to one of the big ones, if not the biggest one.
Yeah, 3.5 years doing the show, and we're hitting a good stride here lately.
Yeah, we are.
To say the least, yeah. James Cameron on the show tonight, if you didn't guess by that series of clips from his filmography, and what an impressive series of films.
It really is. No doubt about that.
Yeah. So we're really excited to bring you his interview tonight. It's going to be a great show. Just a couple of notes before we get started about the show. Movie Geeks United, for those of you that aren't familiar with it out there, that might be new listeners, we usually air twice weekly, live on Sundays at 6 p.m. Eastern and Wednesdays at 10 p.m. Eastern. And all of our shows, and there are more than 300 of them, are available for replay and download from the Blog Talk Radio site at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or through free subscription via iTunes. If you type in Movie Geeks United in iTunes, just press subscribe, and absolutely free, you'll get every episode automatically downloaded on your system there. And you can also check out a complete archive of our more than 500 filmmaker interviews, including people like Francis Ford Coppola and Brian De Palma and Robert Duvall and Paul Schrader and many, 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 many more at our official website at moviegeeksunited.net. All right, and if you're listening to us right now from our Blog Talk Radio page, take a moment to press the follow button, which I believe is right there next to your player on that home page.
It should be.
And, yeah, and what that does is it will allow you to receive automated alerts in your inbox for each of our upcoming shows. You'll get a reminder about an hour before the show starts, so you can stay on top of everything Movie Geeks United related. I think that's all the programming notes I have, Jerry.
Okay. All right. That's good. That's awesome.
We got the business out of the way. So this, you saw Avatar once in the theater, or how many times did you see it?
Just once in the theater.
Me too. I watched it opening weekend, and I'm really thankful for this re-release because this could be the last time we're able to experience it on the big screen in 3D. So I didn't see it in an IMAX screen the first time. So I'm thinking of doing the IMAX 3D.
If you can get in, I mean, at least the like when people no. The reason I say that, just to Mr. Cameron's benefit and everything, is like the IMAX. I think the closest screen here was sold out for weeks in advance.
Oh yeah.
For a long time. So I mean, yeah, if you can, that's what I would imagine is the best way to see it.
Did you not see it? You didn't see it IMAX. You saw regular 3D?
Just the real 3D. That's all I saw it in.
Yeah, I mean, IMAX is so gigantic and immersive in the first place, I can't imagine what that experience is like in 3D.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting to me. So we're really excited about the re-release, and it does get re-released this Friday. And we've covered Avatar a lot on the show.
Yes, we have.
Prior to the December 19th opening last year,
mm-hmm.
we did a show called Inside Avatar, which is our featured show this week there on our homepage below this one. And that show featured Rebecca Keegan, who was James Cameron's biographer, and Stephen Lang, who plays Colonel Quaritch in Avatar.
Mm-hmm.
And then we talked to actress CCH Pounder, who plays Zoe Saldana, her character's mother in the
mm-hmm,
film.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And then we talked to Neville Page, who's one of the creature designers.
That's right, yeah.
In the film. And then we spoke to Robert Stromberg during our Oscar coverage week, because he was nominated for Best Production Design for the movie.
That's right.
And he won. And so as a little teaser to this interview with Mr. Cameron that we're about to start, I wanted to play you just highlights, just quick little highlights of those five interviews. You can find them on our website and in our archive here on the Blog Talk Radio page. Here's a little taste of these conversations for you.
James Cameron is utterly fascinating. And I first met him, I had done a short phone interview with him, but the first time I met him was when I visited the Avatar set in early of 2008. And at the time, there was still a shroud of secrecy surrounding the movie, and I really had no idea what to expect. But I pulled into this dingy warehouse in L.A. and went inside, and there were a few guys working on computer monitors off in the corner, and then there was this big, empty, gray soundstage, and it was Cameron and a computer and a camera. And that was it. He was holding the camera. And to me, it was amazing because, as you guys know, first of all, directors don't hold cameras, not elite directors like Cameron anyway. But it looked to me like this totally postmodern play that was being shot. It didn't look like some big-budget studio movie until he let me look inside his camera lens and see this whole world of Pandora. And at that point, I thought, you know, this is going to be a fascinating movie to watch. How they make it, and this guy seems to only do things that are hard. I'm going to try and stick around if they'll let me.
And I've read quotes from other actors that read Cameron's scripts and say that they don't necessarily read like any other screenplays they've received. Is there something unique about him as a writer actually reading his scripts? How do they read for you?
Well, you know, he's very well schooled. He's very well steeped, I'd say, in literature, both in classical literature and I think in science, and so there's a real there's a kind of a certainty and an authority that one reads in the script. I think he delineates characters very, very clearly, and when I read Avatar, he described a world that is impossible. Right? I mean, he described a world that doesn't exist as we know it. And yet, and this is something I never even considered at the time, I never ever doubted the fact that this would be brought to life. You know? And that's not just because I have confidence in the technology or that confidence in Jim as a director. I think it has to do with the authority of the writing. You know, when you read any great piece of, literature, it doesn't matter whether it's sci-fi, fantasy, or just classical literature. I mean, when you read War and Peace, you're there. You know what it's – Tolstoy paints a very, very, very clear picture.
He really has a very, very clear idea of his story. But if you come in with your story and you give him something that he hadn't seen before, it's like, I hadn't even thought of that before.
Wow.
And he can incorporate it into the story as part of it, because it's a different interpretation, but it doesn't mean that it's a wrong interpretation. And I think his reputation is built on the fact that he's a technical genius, I believe. He knows all of the computer stuff, the digital stuff, the old film, the new film, but he can't act. And it's the one place where he's grateful and he's generous, because you're the people that are making the story come alive.
The four of us were chosen to be this team for a few months to hang out at Jim's house in Malibu and just start conceiving potential ideas for the forest, for the Na'vi, and for the creatures. And 3 months for me turned into 3 years. And it was really one of those things, quite honestly, where Jim saw something that I did not, thank God. And it turned out that I had a particular talent that the other guys didn't, and they had talents that I didn't, and Jim was looking for not the same person, for the same person. He was looking for four different people, and I think that collectively we brought something each unique to the table. But it was, you know, purely, to this day, I still am gobsmacked at the fact that I was one of the four, and I got to hang out with incredible designers who I've admired and learn from them. And and then to see the end product, which is, again, jumping ahead here probably, but to think back to that first day at Jim's house,
yeah,
and to think of where we are now, it's like, good Lord.
When we first ventured into this, you know, the technology was kind of there. And but we had to force it to work. And over time, through trial and error, of course, and we figured it out. The whole, you know, I used to always say it felt like we were, you know, creating an airplane in flight. And in a sense, it was, because from the first step that we did to where we ended up was miles apart in complexity and so on. By the time we were done, we were, you know, fully lighting these digital sets that Jim was working in. It was actually, you know, a fascinating process. We had two traditional art departments, one in Los Angeles and one in New Zealand. We also had a virtual art department in Los Angeles. And so in the traditional art department is where we did all of the concept and design work. In the virtual art department, we built these virtual sets, which allowed Jim to direct in a virtual environment for the first time.
Okay, those are little snippets from the previous interviews we've done concerning Avatar. And that was Cameron biographer Rebecca Keegan, Avatar actor Stephen Lang and CCH Pounder, creature creator Neville Page, and Oscar-winning production designer Robert Stromberg. You can find those all on our archive. Okay, I think we've made the people wait long enough.
Yeah, let's go for it. Let's do it.
Just a little note to the people that have called in and are on hold. This is a recorded interview, so there'll be no callers for Mr. Cameron, obviously. But you might be on the line just listening to the show, so welcome. All right, Avatar re-release this Friday, August 27th, I believe in something like 750 IMAX screens. Could be your last opportunity to see the film in IMAX and in 3D and the way it's meant to be seen and on a big screen. So we spoke to James Cameron earlier in the week about the re-release and some other aspects of his career, and here he is. Enjoy it, everybody.
You're in there. You're here. How much have you logged?
Zip. But I read a manual.
Tell me you're joking.
Go. Don't. Got this.
So you just figured you'd come out here to the most hostile environment known to man, with no training of any kind, and see how it went? What was going through your head?
Maybe I should see the doctor telling me what I couldn't do.
good?
Wing 3 is ready.
Your arm's in. Your hand's in. Head down. Down. Just relax and let your mind go blank. It shouldn't be hard for you.
Just the darkest part of the universe.
Initiate heights.
Jamie, this is Jim.
Hi, Mr. Cameron. How are you, sir?
Fest? Are we going to have a geek fest here?
That's what we're all about. My co-host Jerry is on the line with us, too.
Oh, hey, Jerry. How's
Hi. I'm fine. It's very nice to meet you, Mr. Cameron.
Good. Nice to meet
you. We're very excited about this re-release, and you know, I remember reading kind of your disappointment in the first quarter of the year when you knew that Avatar had to leave some of these 3D screens to make room for the other product, the Clash of the Titans and Alice.
I think it would be pretty crazy to say that we were disappointed with any of that, the release of Avatar. But I think what we saw was a reality that the number of screens, was limiting. That it was a very finite ecosystem. It was big enough, and we're grateful that it was big enough to support one big movie. Because if you really think about it, there was a period of time where it was debatable whether you could even have a big hit movie in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we got past that hurdle. But we didn't get past the second hurdle, which is how do you do two big hit movies at the same time in the marketplace? And that hadn't, it wasn't possible. It's possible now because we've about doubled the number of 3D screens internationally and domestically as well just in the last, 6 months, which is awesome. It means it's all happening, and it's happening, at an accelerating rate. But, what happened was we lost all of our IMAX screens, most of which were selling out on one day. We went to zero. And that was, when Alice in Wonderland came out. So pretty much the next day, I was talking to the IMAX guy, saying, "All right, what's your next opening? What's your next, lull in the action that we can come back in?" I mean, I was thinking about it right away.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've kind of become the official spokesperson and advocate for 3D now.
Right, 3D.
Right, the native 3D,
exactly.
Which I think more and more filmmakers are getting on board with. I know Scorsese's doing his 3D film, which that's an exciting prospect right there. But have filmmakers approached you and questioned you about the technology since Avatar?
Sure, absolutely. I've done a few tutorials and I've done a few phone calls, and I've run out to the camera shop and talked them through it. The thing I tell any director that wants to get into 3D is just get the camera. And just go shoot some stuff for a couple of days, do some tests, learn about stereo space and what you can do and have fun with it, because instead of fearing it and feeling that it's just a limitation, they should start to think about, all right, how can I create my own style in 3D? How can I make this a new set of colors to paint with, And the problem is that there are actually people who are like professional 3D experts. And the problem with these people is when they get on a set with a director and a DP who are new in 3D, what does the stereo guru do? They interpose themselves all the time and talk about all the things you can't do, as opposed to what they should do, which is stand back and say, y'all just carry on doing what you're doing, it'll be great. Because that's the answer, that's the truth. It's like it shouldn't affect your style that much.
Right.
The 3D should always be value added. It shouldn't. It should never be a limitation.
Mm-hmm. But you've always been so unique in that with each project, it seems like you set out to do the impossible. You set out to show people something they've never seen before, and at the same time, you latch on to very familiar kind of universal themes that appeal to the masses. So with Avatar, what were those universal themes that you wanted to explore? And did people latch on to the aspects of the story that you were expecting them to?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, there's not too many movie releases that are kind of like a perfect laboratory experiment, but this was one, because you don't do a film that's the highest grossing film of all time across all cultures and markets if it's not firing on all cylinders. So that way, you don't have to dismiss part of it as having not worked. Mm-hmm. So we know that the action, the visual, all that stuff worked. But we also know kind of pretty definitively that the spirituality, that the environmental themes, mm-hmm. you know, the hippie tree hugger stuff that the studio tried to get me to take out, that worked as well. Maybe not for everybody, but for enough of a majority of the viewers that it vindicated itself.
Do not look in her eyes. Is Down, down, say they. The ground is not horse. When Sahelu is made, the ground will fly with only one hunter in the whole life. To become Aronio. Hunter, you must choose your own Ikran, and he must choose you.
When?
When you are ready.
And I think if you look, you know, historically at big Hollywood movies, I'm not talking about small films or documentaries. I'm talking about like big tentpole movies. There certainly haven't been any that I can think of that are environmentally themed or have that kind of conscience.
No, absolutely.
You know, I mean, yeah. You could say maybe Day After Tomorrow, but that, you know, the science on that was so bad that it, you know, kind of was a setback.
Well, Jerry actually had a question about another aspect of the content.
Yeah,
so.
I think, first of all, my hat's off to you just for making, first of all, the biggest film and ballsiest film about American imperialism I've ever seen.
Well, thank you. Yes,
that's there as well. You know,
a lot of directors
over the past couple of years, the last decade, have tried to make these films that deal with the themes that you were dealing with, and they fell on their faces. They couldn't do it. They're too preachy or whatever, but here you bring up, we were talking to some documentary filmmakers a couple months ago, and I just said that Avatar was probably the biggest cinematic indictment of U.S. imperialism I've ever seen, and does it so well.
You know, I mean, when I was writing the film, I mean, we had, you know, I was writing the film in early 05, and, you know, I mean, I had written a treatment way back earlier,
mm-hmm.
and the story didn't change that much from the treatment, but I think some of the influences were, you know, the fact that we were at the peak of the fighting in the Iraq War. We'd gone in 2 years earlier, but you know, the peak of the prolonged sort of combat period,
right.
And you know, I was just reacting to the fact that I was infuriated by the fact by us going into Iraq in the first place. There was certainly plenty of literature and plenty of information around that you know, that there were no WMD before we went in, and that the whole thing was a big pack of lies, which it
right.
ultimately proved to be. And you know, I was kind of infuriated by that, and so it sort of leaked into the writing. But it's also, you know, I mean, by extrapolation, it's also about the entire, you know, kind of colonial period and this kind of, you know, the whole manifest destiny period of America 150 mm-hmm. years ago, where we were
right.
just sort of busy, you know, like a juggernaut expanding west and taking everything from the indigenous. And that's going on right now in Brazil, the same issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Avatar is happening for real right now in Brazil with these, you know, big hydroelectric dam
mm-hmm.
projects that are displacing literally tens of thousands of indigenous people from their tribal lands, and they're fighting back. And you know, I mean, there was just a situation that happened a couple of weeks ago where 300 Indians from a number of different tribes, you know, came out of the rainforest and took 150 construction workers hostage at a dam project, and it was not very far away from where I had just been. When I say not very far by Brazilian standards, it was a couple hundred miles away. But I'm sure some of the same, indigenous people that I had met with there were involved in this other action. You know, these people are fighting for their lives and their way of life right now. So it goes back deep into history, way before Iraq, and it's going to carry on, I think, for some time, at least until we're all one kind of homogenized society wearing blue jeans and eating McDonald's.
What always interested me about this stage in your career, you've made the two highest grossing movies of all time, and you're as successful, and you've made as much of a mark on the history of the medium as any director in history. So once you've reached that pinnacle, how do you access where you have yet to grow as an artist?
Well, I think you grow as an artist on every film you do, you know, and I like to challenge myself to work outside my comfort zone on everything I do, whether it's on a small documentary or whether it's on one of these big mega pictures, and that's always going to be the case. You know, I think you just have to be restless, and you have to want to challenge yourself to the maximum, both creatively and technically. And I have to hit both of those quadrants for the project to be exciting enough to want to do. Because the thing is, these projects take a lot out of you, you know, both in terms of time away from the family, just, you know, kind of wear and tear. And so they have to be worth it. And to me, they have to be worth it on every level.
Yeah.
For me, it might be challenging in terms of some dramatic point that I'm trying to make, or something that I'm trying to get to with the actors, some moment, the creation of an emotion. And, you know, one of our biggest challenges in Avatar was to create these powerful emotional moments with CG characters.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that all sort of distills back to what the actors created. You know, that was the biggest challenge of the movie, was keeping that emotionality and keeping the process transparent enough that what the actors created was what the characters did, you know, at the end of the day.
Well, your entire career, it's been one incredible accomplishment after another. Can you get kind of turned on by smaller projects, by something that doesn't present those kind of
probably
obstacles?
Not. I mean, I'm a little different than a lot of filmmakers who vary kind of the, you know, there's a lot of filmmakers that sort of have this idea that there's what I do for the paycheck, and maybe I'll find ways to enjoy it, but it's not really my, you know, it's not my passion project. And then I'll do some little project in between to kind of assuage that urge to be completely free of studio constraints. And then I'll go back and do another big one just to, you know, reestablish myself commercially or whatever. And they oscillate back and forth. I'm not interested in that at all. The way it works for me is I'm either making a big, challenging movie, or I'm doing something else. And the something else might be a documentary, it might be ocean exploration, it might be a space project, like literally, I work on space technology projects. Or, you know, going forward, it's going to be working on environment, you know, global warming and renewable energy issues. So those take the place of, you know, those kind of little art movies or little, you know, independent films that some filmmakers feel the need to keep in their diet. I figure what I do best is make big, technically challenging movies, and I love it, and, you know, that's what I'm going to continue to do, or I'm going to be completely outside of the Hollywood system doing something else.
Well, believe me, we love it too. we're not complaining. Before I let you go, I just wanted to ask you about future projects. I know that you've spoken about the Avatar 2 and 3 and your possible film about Hiroshima. Do you have timelines set for yourself on any of these projects?
It's all in flux right now. I mean, I've got to be very careful about how I pick my battles and the order in which I fight them, you know, because it's not like I'm 25 years old. And, you know, there was a time when I figured, I'll get to that one in 15 years. And, you know, after a while, 15 years gets there, and then you make that movie. But, you know, I don't see myself running at quite the speed I run right now, you know, when I'm in my 80s. So I got to pick my battles, and I haven't mapped out. You know, we're talking about big projects that take multiple years, and especially if I'm going to do two of them back to back, I've got to figure out, you know, the exact timetable. So I haven't announced anything yet, and I don't expect to for probably, you know, 6 months at a minimum.
Do you
expect? You know, I mean, everything that you've heard about is still in play, and even a couple that you haven't heard about yet.
Do you expect the Avatar 2 underwater element to be as grueling as your experience on The Abyss? I mean, I don't know how it differs.
Probably not, because it'll be CG. I mean, we'll probably have to figure out a way to do performance capture underwater, which will make it a little wrinkle that we haven't had to deal with before. But, you know, a lot of the underwater stuff can be done without actually being underwater. It can be done, you know, dry for wet, which is how we did it on Avatar.
I'll let you go. I know your schedule's tight today, but thank you so much. We love your work, and can't thank you enough for being on the show with us.
All right, guys. Well, I appreciate your enthusiasm, and thanks for the good questions.
This year, don't miss the biggest adventure of all time. Back on the big screen. In 3D. With never-before-seen footage. For a limited time only. Avatar in select cinemas.
All right, that's James Cameron. The re-release of Avatar is this Friday, August 27th, in IMAX and 3D screens across the country. And then I believe there's a new special edition Blu-ray in November with something like 36 extra minutes, I think I read.
Wow.
And then
the
3D DVD next year.
Oh, my God. Oh my God! I wasn't aware of that. Okay, well that is just incredible.
Yeah,
all right.
plenty of opportunities to get your Avatar on.
He's going
to
do two more of these. I mean, wow.
And two more Avatar films.
I know.
Two
that's
more,
what I mean, and it's a whole process if you think about it. Of course, because a lot of the groundwork has been laid down already. But still, I mean, I'm sorry. Forgive me. 36 minutes.
Well, there's an hour of extra footage.
Oh, I realize that. I realize that. But it's just, you know, you actually hear it. It's like, oh, my God. I mean.
Here's something, because we asked him about whether or not he would consider making smaller films. This is something I found in his biography here. Cameron is fond of saying that all his movies are love stories. And it's true. The apocalypse-straddling romance of the Terminator films, Ripley's maternal love in Aliens, the stale marriages rekindled by potential nuclear annihilation in The Abyss and True Lies, but he has never made a movie in which the love story was the primary reason for the film. And nothing entices him so much as virgin territory. As he had after Terminator 2, Cameron began to contemplate a logistically simpler film after True Lies. Now, I'm reading this anecdote because it's so James Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
He told his friend, his close friend, director Guillermo del Toro, "I want to do a small movie next to prove to people I'm not just about giant movies, about spectacle. I'm going to do a love story." Del Toro, believing his friend really was looking for an intimate scale tale to tell, recommended Cameron read The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, the poignant novel about a deaf mute and a teenage tomboy living in a small Georgia town in the 30s. Many months later, Cameron went back to Del Toro, and he said, "I'm writing my love story. Do you want to read it?" And Del Toro said, "Sure." And Cameron said, "It happens on the Titanic."
Ah, that is classic. That's great.
Yeah, that is great. But, you know, do we really want to see a small movie from James Cameron? It's like, would we really want to see Avatar from Woody Allen? You know,
yeah,
they're directors with their own identities.
Their own identities, but I would want to, you know, with directors like that, I would only want to see films that they made, that they wrote and they direct, you know, that they wanted to make. I don't want to see, you know, James Cameron says, "I'm going to go ahead and do a small movie just for the sake of doing a small movie," and his heart's not in it. I really don't care about it, you know? I mean, I want to see him do something. And his idea of a small movie, mind you, may be something that someone else, another director, might consider a huge movie. So it's also just matters of perception, too.
Right.
I would be really curious if he did say what his idea of a small movie is.
Yeah, I mean, he expressed it there. It's not worth his time unless...
Right.
It's challenging him in some way. And this isn't a guy that just lounges around. This is a guy in his spare time. I mean, he's building a submarine right now. He's building a camera for the Mars rover right now for NASA. You know,
the combination of Clive Cussler's Dirk Pitt and Howard Hughes and, oh, God, just a whole host of things. I mean, this guy does everything. But he's like Buckaroo Banzai, real honest to God, Buckaroo Banzai. He does everything. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and plus his movies too. You know, I've read this biography a couple of times. Of course, when we first had the author on, Rebecca Keegan, it's a good biography. It's called
a great interview. That was a great
It's called The Futurist, The Life and Films of James Cameron, and it includes coverage of Avatar and the filming of it. But in that, you know, people give him a rap that he made a movie about primitive people in Avatar who survive and fight for survival with what they have at their disposal, bows and arrows against machine guns and all that kind of stuff, as it says in the trailer. And so people brought up the irony that, you know, you're using all this advanced technology to basically do an anti-technology movie. and he's always been comfortable with that ambiguity, because when you think about it, Terminator 2, he calls that a violent movie about peace.
Mm-hmm.
And he has no problem with that ambiguity. It's interesting how he works, and there are social messages in each film, and I think that's what people latch on to in his films. And there's also the spectacle. If it were blank spectacle, it would not be the highest grossing movie of all time.
No, I agree with you there. I think there is, and I just, like I was telling you before we interviewed him, several of all my filmmaking friends are very influenced by his work. There's like nice winks to him in their films. He's very influential, but like you said, there is a message in those movies. Hell, let's even go back to, while people would laugh, even Piranha 2, there's an ecological message way ahead of its time. But I'm not being facetious. I'm actually being pretty serious.
Now, that's pushing it.
No. There's a whole bunch of this film from those times. It's like that. There's a couple of horror movies that really were like about, like, how should we say it? About if you see how like farm-raised salmon is raised and everything, you'd be like, oh my God, these horror films from the early 80s were like dead on. They were like,
yeah.
I mean, I am being somewhat facetious, but there is actually a little bit of truth there, actually. He puts a lot, there is a message in everything he does, even in The Abyss, in The Titanic. I mean, there is definitely, there's so much there. And a lot of people just want to write it off. It's just a movie. And, yeah, you can do that. I mean, people will do that. There are always going to be those people do it, but there are messages in those films.
When something like Titanic or Avatar become the first and second highest grossing movie of all time, just as Star Wars and E.T. were before it, it's something more than a movie. It's some kind of cultural kind of phenomenon. It taps into something. Now, whether you get that or not, I mean, that's personal taste, but you can't dismiss the fact that billions of so many people worldwide do get it for some reason. They connect to it in some way.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason. I mean, and there are a lot of reasons, I think, behind Avatar. There are a lot of reasons that some people, that maybe Americans might not like, but there is a reason. There are reasons, many, and not just one reason. There are many reasons. A lot of people, there's the entertainment, there's the spectacle level, but there's probably something deeper if you go a couple layers beneath that. So
well, he's come out and he said some controversial things in the past weeks in the press. One of which was about 3D and his take that 3D will get to a place where you no longer have to refer to it as a 3D film. It'll be so kind of commonplace in the market.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which could happen. I mean, look, I would not doubt this guy and his vision, because people told him that 3D was a gimmick and it was over before he started shooting Avatar.
Right.
And people have doubted him throughout his career, and he's pretty much proven them wrong
every time.
And the 3D has taken over a lot, and I think we're going to see a better quality of 3D outside of the conversion stuff, because now they're starting to shoot native 3D. He's been advocating.
Yeah, the conversion. Even he admitted it overheated with the conversions and everything. I think in that interview we're talking about, I guess the Entertainment Weekly, he said, it just like everything's being converted, and that's not the same thing as shooting it in 3D. He's very quick to point that out. You know, not everything, but he does. He is like the Hurt Locker. He said would be great in 3D.
Yeah, he did, and that was one of the controversial statements that he made, which we didn't ask him about that, but because my question would be, you know, what was Catherine Bigelow's take on that? And
mm-hmm.
but I don't know.
We didn't want to go there.
But I don't think it changed. I don't think it affects content. I think it affects form. I think it affects the experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Right.
So would Hurt Locker be a better film in 3D? I personally don't think so, but I think that it would definitely enhance the experience.
Now let me ask you this: we're talking about if it was actually shot in 3D, like actually,
yeah that's
not
what
converted.
He's talking
we're talking
too.
About actually shot. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say. I honestly couldn't tell you. I don't think for that kind of film, it would add to. Like you said, I don't think it would be a richer experience, but I don't know.
It would be an enhanced experience. I just don't think it would be a better film.
Right.
I mean, the film is great because of the content of the film.
Right. Mm-hmm. The
not necessarily the form.
Yeah, and that's what I think we got to remember. At the end of the day, it is. I think it's the content, as you say, that's going to really determine the longevity of the film. If it's just spectacle, then no, that's not going to last more than a couple of weekends, you know, at the box office. But if it is, it's beyond that. If it has the content, and let's face it, his films have the content, so regardless of the form. So,
yeah. And 3D has moved into the independent feature realm as well, and we're going to be talking to a filmmaker at the end of the show who's leading that charge. His name is Graham Resnick, and he's producing a 3D or directing a 3D film right now. He's in pre-production on it, and he'll be telling us about that and his new film, which is a horror film called I Can See You, which has received raves from like New York Times and like all over the place. And
right.
It's available on DVD, and it features a short film, which he's basing his feature film on, that's actually in 3D. So the DVD comes with the glasses and everything.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I have a quick announcement.
Okay.
Something I should have said on Sunday, and I didn't, and I felt like a jackass, so I'm going to say it now. I just wanted to belated congratulations to Frances Abbey and the crew of Boxing Day for winning the best comedy feature at this. We had this local World Music and Independent Film Festival in the Washington area this weekend, and they won the best comedy feature. And Vicki Harford won best supporting, I believe it was, best supporting actress in a film. And she was the mom in the movie, and she was great. And the whole cast was great. But I just want to shoot out a congratulations to all the cast and crew of the film.
I saw him posing with his awards.
Yeah,
it was cool.
It was cool. So I just wanted to say that I didn't get a chance to say that on Sunday because I forgot like a dummy. So that's my belated congratulations to all of them. They all deserved it and earned it.
That's good. Yeah. Boxing Day. Which we've covered on the show.
We have covered. We interviewed everyone, almost everyone, but we interviewed a lot of people. It was a lot of fun. That was a good show. I really enjoyed that.
This Sunday, just to let people know, this Sunday we have the star of The Last Exorcism, Patrick Fabian. He plays the exorcist in it. He's the Max von Sydow role.
You're right.
Yeah. Well, I guess so.
Film. Yeah.
I guess so. Are you going to watch that this weekend, The Last Exorcism?
If I have time, the movie I really want to see is that Australian crime movie that's supposed to open here, Animal Kingdom. I want to see that. I definitely want to see that. I am curious about The Last Exorcism, but I'm more curious.
Yeah, I'm curious. That is a movie that could be a phenomenon of its own along the lines of Paranormal Activity, I think, if it works.
If it works, but I have no idea, so.
And then next Wednesday night, we have a roundtable discussion. We have our fall movie preview. And then Monday through Friday the following week, September 6th through September 10th, every night at 10 p.m. Eastern, we have a five-part tribute series to five different Brian De Palma thrillers, including Sisters, Carrie, Dressed to Kill, Blowout, and Raising Kane. And we have a real extensive lineup of great guests booked for that show, and we're awaiting word to see if we get one more guest for that series. That could be really exciting. So
it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, so stay posted to our Facebook updates if you're not already friends of ours on Facebook to hear more updates about guests for that show and upcoming shows. So we got an exciting lineup of shows, but let's talk about some movie news right now.
Okay, whoa, movie news. Okay, now I didn't prepare for this. Okay, cool.
Well, this
I'm going to think on my feet, so good.
This is the element of the part of the show where I start surprising you.
Okay,
cool. Oh, by the way, last show we had on Brian Tyler.
Yes, we did.
The composer of The Expendables and Rambo and Eagle Eye and lots of great movies. And I looked on his Facebook page today, and he said, did you see it, his Facebook page?
No, I'll go to it right now.
I'm about to read you what it says. I'm going to go to it. But he actually, we're hoping that he participates in our Name That Film Tune trivia show in mid-September. He seemed open to it. But he posted a message on his Facebook page that said, I am tripping out that this week I was the guest of Movie Geeks United, and next week's guest is James Cameron. What? Thanks for taking... That's what he says. I tried to dramatize what he typed out. I'm sorry if that didn't work. Thanks for talking, guys. It was a blast. So, thank you, Brian. It was really fun
you.
For us.
It's always good to have him on. I love talking to him. He's great.
Okay, here's the most puzzling piece of movie news of the day. Featuring my idol, Al Pacino. Did you read this?
No. Oh, my God. Now I'm really curious to hear what this is.
Al Pacino will be in the next Adam Sandler comedy.
Billy Madison, The Lonely Years? What? What is it? I mean...
It's called Jack and Jill, where Adam Sandler plays twin siblings, both the boy and the girl.
Oh.
The love interest in the film is Katie Holmes. It's directed by Dennis Dugan, who's done several Adam Sandler movies, and... Pacino apparently plays himself in it.
Plays himself in it. Well, okay. Well, look, Jack was in Anger Management, but he wasn't playing... Well, he was kind of playing himself. But, you know...
Meryl Streep was in Stuck on You.
That's true. So, wait, Allison, and he's playing both roles, Adam Sandler, the twins? I mean, both?
Yeah. I mean, that's the gimmick of the movie. Yeah.
Oh, my... This didn't work. This didn't even work for Greta Garbo and Two-Faced Woman. I mean, what this makes you think it can work for him? I mean, I'm sorry. No, this is always a bad idea. All right, it worked, obviously, for the Parent Trap movies, the remake, the original and the remake. But, I mean, outside of that, we haven't had a great track record here. I mean, didn't do one...
Victor Victoria,
him.
Dude. Victor
what?
Victoria.
Oh, Victor Victoria, they had... That was... I'm not going to put that in the same... Oh, who knows? But Al Pacino in an Adam Sandler movie. I've seen everything now. This is going to be very interesting.
Yeah.
As itself.
Yeah, because if you're going to play anything, if you're going to be in an Adam Sandler movie, it's probably akin to playing yourself. Play with yourself. So that's some puzzling movie news that came out today. Hang on, I'm trying to bring up the other stories of movie news. By the way, if anyone out there wants to call in and share some thoughts on Cameron or anything in the movie realm as of late, you guys can call in to the show. The number to call in is 718-508-9477. And if you missed any part of Mr. Cameron's interview, this show is available on archive replay right after the live airing. So it should be... About a half hour after we close off the show, it'll be available for replay, so you can hear it from the beginning. Oscar honorees, did you read about that?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Of course, every year the Oscars have their honoree, have a list of honorees, and they used to air one or two of them during the live telecast, which they stopped that for time considerations, which is a joke. It just allowed them to add two more musical numbers. But they have... See, I don't have a problem with it not being televised in the Oscar cast. I know a lot of people do, for good reason. But the entire evening is broadcast on the web, or was last year. And it's a lot more relaxed and comfortable. The honorees enjoy it a lot more. And it's a much longer form tribute as well, so there's a lot more to savor. This year's list of honorees, I didn't even write them down. I know do you have them?
I have them. Well, we have Francis Ford Coppola.
Yes.
We have Kevin Brownlow, who wrote a wonderful biography of David Lean. We have Jean-Luc Godard and Eli Wallach.
We have Jean-Luc Godard?
Yeah. They can't find him, supposedly, to tell him. I just read that article somewhere online.
Jean-Luc Godard?
Yeah. I'm sorry, you know.
You always crack me up, man.
Yeah, thank you.
You're the best. I love that. Yeah, but who's the Godard, Coppola,
Wallach, and Kevin Brownlow? He's a film historian, and he's a silent film preservationist. And
I think that's a great lineup.
He interviewed one of them too. That helps.
Yeah, I mean, Wallach has had an amazingly long and varied career as an actor.
Yeah, I mean, he's still, I mean, the ghostwriter this year, and I mean, yeah, it's just incredible.
And it's great that Coppola's being honored, too. So I think that's a great lineup. So that usually happens, what, a week before the award ceremony?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think.
So that's something to look forward to. Here's another piece of movie news. Dustin Hoffman is back in Fockers.
Yeah, that's a real shocker. I mean, come on, he's not going to pass that up. I mean, didn't he do that Toy Story movie a couple of years ago? I mean,
no, I mean he did pass it up.
I don't know. I mean, Harvey Keitel's in it. Well, who is Harvey Keitel playing in the movie?
Probably Harvey Keitel. It's
okay,
probably like Pacino in the Adam Sandler movie. I don't know. I don't know what he plays. But I don't necessarily think funny whenever I think Harvey Keitel. But the Hoffman actually turned it down when it was first presented to him, and they finished shooting. So it was surprising to me that he's going to be in it, because he's going to be in it for four scenes that they're doing on reshoots.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty extensive reshoot schedule for it, and they're incorporating him in it. And does that spell trouble to you? That's more than a cameo. So it has to change the structure of the film for big scenes with Dustin Hoffman that weren't originally included.
Does anyone really care?
I mean, this movie, well, I'm sure Universal cares. This movie has gone through test screenings, and I'm wondering, did the test screenings not turn out right, and so they went back and tried to sweet talk Dustin Hoffman to save the movie?
Wow, that's the first in a long time. Wow,
I'm a conspiracy theorist. That's what
I just the Hoffman to say, oh my God! I mean, that's what he's their knight in shining armor for this one.
I think it was the funniest part of the last one.
Oh, I know. I mean, anything would have helped, but I mean, I don't know.
Anything would have helped.
I don't know. I didn't really, you know, I liked the first one was all right. The second one got all my nerves, the things I'm really looking forward to.
All right, let's take a call. We got Dean on the line.
I killed Jamie's interest right there. He has to take a call.
Hey, Dean, what's up?
Hey, what's going on?
What's up, man?
You called us. You tell us what's going on.
Yeah, what's going on, man? What's the good word?
Well, I was just really happy to hear about the four honorees this year.
Are you going to go to that? Are you going to get drunk with all of them?
All right, Dean. You have to be in your. You must be in your apartment because we can't hear a word you're saying on your phone.
Oh yeah, really? How about now?
Now's good.
Now's okay. Now's good. I can hear you.
All right. So I'm like half of my body is out the window right now. It's ridiculous. I was really pleased with Kevin Brownlow getting an honorary Oscar, because I really love his he is a documentary filmmaker. He did all the he's done a lot of TV things
mm-hmm.
that you've seen on PBS, like Unknown Chaplain, and
right.
He did one on Harold Lloyd and one on Buster Keaton.
Yeah,
and
he wrote that great biography of David Lean a while back.
Yeah, and a lot of other books too.
Mm-hmm.
I've never read any of his books, but he also has done narrative films too. He did one particularly great narrative film back in the mid '60s If you haven't seen it, you should watch it. It's called It Happened Here, and it takes place in Britain after World War II, and it posits what would have life in Britain been like had Hitler won the war.
Mm-hmm.
And it really feels like a pretty period piece. It really gets the feeling of just the look of the film and the look of the time period pretty down pretty pat, on a very probably low budget. So.
What's the film called?
It Happens Here.
Okay.
Well, that's like a play on the Sinclair Lewis book, It Can Happen Here.
Oh, that I didn't know. But
that's a great book that was really way ahead. It was written in the 30s, and that was one of those really important novels. It's been, I think, reprinted again over the last decade. But what is this movie like? Sounds like the Oswald Mosley wet dream. I mean,
it's really something else. You just have to go and take a look at it. But it's really brilliant. I think he's done three narrative movies, and the rest are all documentaries. And of course, mm-hmm. he might be most famous for bringing Napoleon.
That's right.
Abel Gance's Napoleon back to theaters in the early 80s.
1982. We saw that at the Kennedy Center. That was great. Talk about an awesome, awesome soundtrack.
Yeah, it is. And do you know the whole story behind that? Why that's not available on DVD or anything like that right now?
Can it be shown? Let me ask you this: how would you experience that? Because they had it was like on three screens. They had the way it was presented.
Yeah.
How would you show that on TV? I just don't. That would be really wild how you get away with that.
Well, it was put out on VHS.
Bravo, I mean, used to show it. But I mean, just that experience, recreating that experience, though, was.
Yeah, well, there would never be like anything like watching it in front of, in a big auditorium with Carmine Coppola conducting the orchestra
right in front of you. That's true. Mm-hmm.
But the deal with why that movie is not out on DVD yet is because Brownlow has gone back and done some more restoration on Gance's movie. And he wants to release it with original music and not without Carmine Coppola's score. And Francis Ford Coppola won't let him do it, and standing in the way. So because he says that the movie won't be anything without Carmine Coppola's score. I don't know if he really says that or not, but
there's some truth to that, though. There is some truth. I have to agree with Francis there. There is some truth.
It would be a shame to not hear. But what they should do is just do the whole thing of just release both versions of it, in a big box set or something. But because it would be ridiculous not to have the Carmine Coppola score on it. So mm-hmm.
I completely agree.
Hang on, Dean.
I'm extending the invitation if you want to call in 718-508-9477 and play Dean on a round of trivia. We can do that if we get a call in the next minute or so.
We'll see what happens.
Isn't that exciting?
But I hope that Coppola and Brownlow, like when they're at the thing together, they'll mend fences somehow.
There's going to be a fist fight.
Yeah. And then Eli Wallach will get in between them and get a black eye.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I think that Coppola's mellowed. I mean, that happens with age. But, I mean, he used to be rumored as a... I mean, I know that Robert Evans said that he'll never speak to him again, but maybe Coppola is happy about that. I don't know who's the villain there, but...
I don't know. I have no idea.
Okay. Anything else, Dean, that you want to discuss?
No, I'm just going to hang out and just listen to what you have to say or whatever and chime in.
No, you can hang out for you can hang around for a movie trivia. Oh, by the way, hi, 760?
Yep, I'm here.
Hey, Nicholas?
Yeah.
All right.
Hey, buddy.
Hey,
Nicholas.
Hey, Dean.
You and Dean are going to go head-to-head in just a second on movie trivia. And if anyone else wants to join in, feel free to call in. But first of all, did any of you guys see the Spike Lee
documentary to When the Levees Broke on HBO?
No, I didn't get a chance to yet. I'm going to watch it when it's repeated.
Not yet for me either.
I watched it on demand. I watched all 4 hours of it on demand, and I mean, it's very good. I like his documentary work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, me too.
But my favorite is still Four Little Girls,
mm-hmm.
among his documentaries.
Yeah.
All right.
The only thing I've watched this week was two Mumblecore movies. By the way, I just watched Baghead and because I'm in love with Greta Gerwig, I watched Baghead and Nights and Weekends, which sort of co-directed kind of with the lead, and I really like them both. By the way, Greta Gerwig is playing the Liza Minnelli role in the remake of Arthur.
Really?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? Opposite Russell Brand?
Yeah. And it's I believe that Nick Nolte is playing the role of the father, of the rich father that.
No. Oh, well, that's possible, I guess.
I think I think it's Louis Guzman who's playing the chauffeur.
Oh, okay.
That's my guess.
Jerry, I'd rather not, if you mean that literally.
No, I don't. No.
okay. Okay. Nicholas, I'll give you the first question. Your category is potluck. All right, you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. In which film did a character named Gale Weathers first appear?
Weathers, that's Scream.
That is Scream. 1 point, Nicholas. Jerry, keep track of this because I don't have anything to write on.
Okay, yeah, all right.
All right, Dean, here's your question. It's also potluck. Who won the Best Director Oscar for The Sound of Music?
Robert Wise.
You're very wise. That is correct. Dean, or I'm sorry, Nicholas.
Yes.
Your category is Meryl Streep. And your question is, in which Woody Allen film did she appear in 1979?
Manhattan.
Very good. Dean, your category is Tom Hanks.
Mm-hmm.
Your question is, he met his wife, Rita Wilson, on the set of which movie?
Was it Volunteers?
It was Volunteers, yes.
Very
two,
good.
Two.
I pulled
two,
that one
two.
Out, man.
Nicholas.
Yes.
Here's your question. The category is Who's Who? And your question is this. Wow, I don't know the answer to this one. Who was the only actress to divorce a future U.S. president?
Whoa. I know that.
I know that, too.
Oh, God. If I were to probably guess Greta Garbo, I have no idea. That's a very hard question.
It's Jane Wyman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is Jane Wyman. So Dean steals that point.
Okay, so Dean's in the lead then?
So it's what, 3-2?
3-2, yeah, all right. You can take points in this, okay. All right.
Yeah, I'm allowing it.
All right.
Dean, potluck is your category. Your question is, what was Bruce Willis's first film in 1987?
Oh, man. Let's see.
Well, it's not his first film in 1987. It's
the
first film he ever did.
Released,
it was released in 1987, yeah.
Oh, I see.
Was it Blind Date?
That's what it was.
Yep.
Very good.
I can't believe that.
Very good.
See, sometimes Nick, I know things that I don't think I know. So.
Yes, you're exceptional that way. Nicholas, your category is potluck. Your question is, which Jonathan was featured in Star Trek First Contact?
Oh, it's Jonathan, oh my God, is it Jonathan Frakes?
Yes.
I hope I pronounced that correct.
You're right. Dean, your category is potluck. Here is your question.
God.
Dramatic. You should have music
really,
and everything.
Yeah, yeah. Your question is, which George was featured in Look Who's Talking?
Which George was featured in... Wait a minute. Let me think about this for a second. You know, I don't know this one. I'm like drawing a complete blank.
Nicholas, do you know this one?
I do. It's George Fiegel.
Did Nicholas win that round?
Well, it's,
Jerry?
It's tied. It's tied.
Oh, I thought it was 5-4 with that answer.
No, I missed the question about Ronald Reagan.
I didn't mean to get your hopes up, Nicholas. I'm sorry.
It's four all.
4-4. All right.
So the first one to miss one is the winner? Is that the...
First one to get to 5.
First one
okay.
to get to 5. Thank you.
All right, Dean, here's your question. And if anyone else wants to play movie trivia, now's the time to call in, 718-508-9477. Your category is Oscars Who's Who. Your question is, how many nominations had Helen Hunt received before winning for As Good As It Gets?
None.
You're right. That's the game. And yet again, I don't have applause, sound effects, or anything to signify victory. But
it takes away from the game show kind of thing. But
yeah, I need cheesy theme music too, like da 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 da.
Yeah,
something like
you really
that.
Do. Just, but yeah, the cheesier, like sort of like free kind of music that you can find. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for playing, guys.
Thank you.
All right. It was fun.
You go home with absolutely nothing. I'm sorry to say.
Thanks. Can you let us know when you do your next trivia night, all right, man?
September 15th, Wednesday the 15th.
But wait, that's going to be all the music guys, right? So
yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's right. We can play that.
The way we're planning it now, it'll be all composers playing Name That Film Score against each other. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You could have like a little segment of just normal plebeians doing it.
We could. But we're not. Thank you guys.
Thanks,
all right,
guys.
Talk to you later.
All right, bye.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.
All right. That's movie trivia.
That is movie trivia. Thank bloody God for that.
It's the only trivia show where you win absolutely nothing. But bragging rights are important for movie geeks, I think.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Did you know the answers to all those questions, Jerry?
I was surprised how much I knew.
Yeah. Hey, the Emmys are... What is it? This weekend? The Emmys?
This Sunday. Isn't it this Sunday? And, you know, it's looking like a good one.
Well, it's looking good for me because I know that Pacino won Best Actor.
True. Are you placing bets on that? Are you?
it's a sure thing. He's going to win Best Actor.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he will. I can't imagine he's not.
But somebody actually, like the local newspaper here, asked me for my picks, for my Emmy picks.
That's good. Congratulations. That's great.
I'm like, you guys know that I'm not a TV guy, right?
But no, but TV, we're living in an age of really great television, though, so that's fine. That's good. I mean, you do take what you can get. I mean,
I don't know anything about TV, so I just chose, like, Glee and Mad Men for everything.
I think that's a safe assumption. I mean,
I think so, too. But the Emmys are, like, I see the Emmys that they give out. I don't know if it's like the Emmys or the TV version of the TV awards or the Golden Globes, but don't they give out like to the same shows every single year? Don't they give out like 12 in a row to Tony Shalhoub for Monk?
Yeah, well, maybe them. I know the Golden Globes is like that, but no, the Emmys. That's a good question. But I do think we're really living in the last couple of years, I think some really great television, especially like the sitcom and the hour-long drama are just like really, I don't know, I was like saying this the other day on another show, there's just a lot of room to move around in TV because there's so many outlets now.
Hey, I don't understand the Emmys. Just like the Grammys, I don't understand the Grammys.
Well, the Grammys are just impossible to follow. I have no idea how that's done.
What's the timeline? I mean, they're nominating songs that came out like 2 years ago.
Yeah, it does seem that way.
Well, like a song will win, and it was released as a single 2 years before. I don't understand the timeline for the Grammys.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll always, have you noticed that, you know, they try to be current and cutting edge. They've added all these categories to accommodate the new styles of music.
Mm-hmm.
So the kids will tune in, I'm sure. But then, like, the best album, they'll always give it to the oldest fogey among the group.
That's true.
They'll give it to Steely Dan. They'll give it to Dylan, which Dylan's great, but, I mean.
Right.
I don't know about Steely Dan, but, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. No,
give it to
Don
Henley and Alison Krauss.
There's a lot of truth to what you're saying. That's the sad thing.
Well, it is true.
Yeah,
I mean that's who they give the award, the best albums to every year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm sure Barry will be up for something this year.
There you go.
Yeah. So fall movie preview. You're looking forward to that?
I am looking forward to that. There's a lot of things to go see, so I am looking forward to it. There's actually some really good movies. We kind of did this when we did our 2010 preview last November.
Yeah,
we kind of touched on some of those, but we didn't have a full spread of what's coming out at this time of year yet. So much has changed actually since we did that. So many release dates have been shifted and everything. So
we started. We would do it September through December, right?
Yes.
Okay, I'm always buzzing. I know when the seasons are. I don't know how they delineate the movie season. So
no, it is. But remember, we did like a full show just of what was coming out in 2010.
Yeah.
And a lot of the movies that we talked about, not a lot, but a good chunk of those, have been pushed back to next year. You know, there's some high profile ones, and then there's some movies that we're looking forward to in the beginning of the year have been pushed back to this time of year now. So it's going to be interesting. I'm very curious. I guess we're using the Entertainment Weekly as our template.
No, I have a special calendar through IMDb Pro that I use.
Oh, okay, that's a good one. Yeah, all right, good.
But I'm still waiting for that Dahmer versus Gacy.
There you go. Yeah, that.
Remember, we covered that in the 2000s.
I do. I remember that.
I mean, that's as comprehensive as it gets, right there.
You can't ask for better.
So, do you think Tron Legacy will be the highest grossing movie, at least of the fall? But do you think it has a chance of being it for the year?
It's going to be it's been between that and the Harry Potter movie, I think.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Inception and Toy Story 3. Well, Toy Story 3 has just done phenomenal. And then Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, surprisingly enough.
I know, and that just doesn't leave much of an impression at all, Alice in Wonderland. So I don't know. No, I think Tron. Now, here's the thing. Now, let me ask you this, though. Oh, God. Is Tron Legacy, do you think Tron Legacy, even though it is Comic-Con, where it's been very popular and everything, and that's where, do you think that there is enough interest outside of that base?
Right.
That is something to be very conscientious of right now, because there's a lot of things to say Comic-Con isn't really, and we've talked about this many times on the show over the years, it's a good, yeah, it's a great place to create buzz, but does that buzz transcend the base? And that's what we have to see with Tron.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about it with Kick-Ass and Scott Pilgrim,
yeah,
which are two,
I mean,
which are two great movies, but
mm-hmm.
But will the masses go see Tron? That's a good question. I don't know. I'm sure that some of them will come with, for nostalgia,
mm-hmm.
and some of them will come because they are the fanboy crowds. What the movie has to do is what Avatar did and promise to show you an experience that it's exciting,
yeah.
and something you've never experienced before.
Exactly. You really have to. That you're right. It's the experience. You have to sell the experience. I think, like Avatar, definitely.
Have you rewatched the original Tron anytime recently?
Dude, I think the last time I watched Tron was when I saw it in the theater in 1982, if you went to God's Honest Truth.
Yeah. And I'm sure then it looked the cutting edge, and now it looks like Pong.
Well,
but,
what is the, one of our, Joel in the chat room, the first Tron sucks ass. So, I mean, right there.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, Chris saw it, our other movie geek, and he said that it was incredibly dated.
Mm-hmm.
Are there movies like that for you that feel too dated to enjoy? Is that ever a problem for you?
Oh, there are some that I watch. I would imagine Tron would definitely be like that, but I'm trying to see what other. They're usually movies from that time, like Cloak and Dagger or.
Oh, God, I used to watch Cloak and Dagger all the time.
I know, all the
time
when we were kids. I actually, you know, for a while there, Red Dawn, feels incredibly dated. I mean, even at the time of its release, it was kind of laughable that the Cubans and the Nicaraguans are going to invade us like that. That was some, but that I like it. I mean, don't get me wrong, I like it. It's a great, great 80s action film, but I'm just trying to think. Name me some other films from, like, the early 80s or something, and I'll... Is that for the one? And there's some 90s films too. Virtuosity, The Net, Johnny Mnemonic, which is just god awful even when it came out. Very disappointing.
Right,
even with the gay, had a great cast and everything, but it was still a lot of those movies, like from the first, The Lawnmower Man. We were talking about that with when we were talking about Brian Taylor, The Lawnmower Man. I mean, that just feels a lot of those early virtual reality movies. Are just really cheesy, I think, by today's standards that were made in the 90s.
Do you know, I never saw the film The Lawnmower Man because I was ticked off about it. Did you ever read Stephen King's story, The Lawnmower Man?
No. I know I should, but I haven't.
It has absolutely nothing to do with the movie.
That does not surprise me.
And I don't know how they got away with it by calling it Stephen King's The Lawnmower Man, because the actual... story. It's a short story. I think it's in, I don't know what collection it's in, but I used to love to read Stephen King, especially his short stories. But
right.
The story is about this guy. His family's left for the weekend, and his grass is like unmanageable. It's grown so long, he's let it go for so long. So he hires a lawn guy to come in and mow the grass so it'll be nice and pretty when the wife and the kids come home after the weekend. So it's just a weird little story. He looks outside. The lawnmower man's really obese. He strips down naked.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mower that doesn't have a bag on it, apparently, and it's shooting grass as it cuts it. It's going on. It's riding on its own, and he's squatting and on all fours and crawling behind it, eating the grass as it shoots out.
Mm-hmm.
And then he takes a lawnmower and runs over the owner of the house with it and you know, slices him to bits. And the family comes home, and they see pieces of him all over the place. That's the story, The Lawnmower Man, the short story. So what does it have in common with the film?
Well, that's the guy in the chat room. It has a lawnmower in it. What more do you want? Remember, there's a whole period here where they tried to cash. They wanted to cash in on Stephen King's name, and they just, you know, and of course the things didn't have very much to do with the original source, you know, the source material. But I don't know. Like I said, that's a film that it seems dated.
Maximum Overdrive was pretty bad.
Right? He directed that. Nothing could. Yeah, that just. Yeah, I watched that. That was actually. I think was that on? Did Mystery Science Theater make fun of that? I think they did actually.
Being dated is the least of the problems that Maximum Overdrive had.
Yeah, really. Great soundtrack, horrible movie.
But what are the best Stephen King adaptations, do you think?
Oh, I think Carrie, The Shining. I think The Shining. I don't care what Mr. King says. I think The Mist is one of the best recently. Misery, Stand By Me, Shawshank Redemption. I mean, they're actually, as we've gotten further away, the more recent, there are a lot of really good ones that have made their way over the years.
There's some I don't remember very well. Like, I don't remember Silver Bullet.
Oh, with the Werewolf, yeah.
The Coors Beer Wolf?
It just looked like when they showed the werewolf at the end, it just looked like the Coors Beer Wolf from the commercials at that time.
But I do remember one that was good that was never really spoken about as much as it should have been. That was Needful Things. Remember
that? That was interesting.
Ed Harris, Max von Sydow,
Bonnie Bedelia.
Yeah. And then,
Cemetery,
the
first Pet Cemetery was good. I remember liking that when it came out.
I guess I did too, but I was also disappointed because the book Pet Cemetery, it's the only book that ever scared me.
Okay.
And as I was reading, I was thinking, I'm being scared by a book, and that had never happened before or since. And so the movie didn't match that experience for me. But there was another Stephen King movie I had in mind. Oh, and when people talk about Tobe Hooper, Texas Chainsaw is obviously scary for me. The movie he pretended to direct in Poltergeist is effective. But we overlook Salem's Lot, and I thought Salem's Lot
was very effective. Yeah.
And that was done as a TV miniseries.
Mm-hmm. That's right, the late 70s, yeah. That was an enormously big deal back then. And Cujo.
And if you want your project to be dated, cast David Soul.
The movie? I just saw a movie with David Soul in it.
Oh, did you?
New movie.
I think he's been in new movies lately, yeah.
I did not recognize him. I'll have to go. I want to go look this up. You keep talking. I'll go do this.
Because
thunderstruck by it. I was like, oh, my God, that's David Soul? And I was just like, holy shit.
And a couple of years ago we had, I guess it was, when did Cujo come out, 83,
I think. 83.
So that was the summer of 83. That's when we had Dee Wallace on to talk about Cujo.
He was in Farewell.
Oh, that's right. You're right.
I was just like, holy smokes, man. That's mm-hmm. David Soul. Oh, my God.
He's got soul.
Yeah,
but Cujo does work, too. And I'm curious what happened to Louis Teague. Who directed that in Jewel of the Nile, and I don't know what else Louis Teague did. But Cujo, in the book, the kid died, if you remember. And Stephen King didn't necessarily want it to happen. It just kind of wrote itself that he died, and so he left it because it's just what came out.
Right.
But for the movie, they couldn't get by with that. I mean, the struggle that they went through for 90 minutes to survive and have it be all for naught at the end with a kid dying. They couldn't do that to audiences. So,
right.
All right. Well, there's our Stephen King conversation.
That was good. That was very good. I never read Cujo. So,
Apt Pupil, which wasn't quite the follow up to Usual Suspects.
I like that movie, though. I like Apt Pupil. I know it wasn't the follow-up, but I do like it, though.
And Guy in the chat room, you're absolutely right. Dolores Claiborne is an incredible movie, and I think. And it's all in the performances of Kathy Bates and Jennifer Jason Leigh and the direction of that movie.
Dean brings up one of the best ones that we've read, The Dead Zone. Cronenberg,
yeah, The Dead Zone.
Dead Zone. That's just incredible. I love that movie.
Yeah, so he has produced, there have been some great movies that have been produced from his work.
Yeah, I mean, there have been, The Dead Zone is just an incredible film.
Yeah, yeah, and Christopher Walken is so perfectly cast for that movie.
Martin Sheen's great, too.
Yeah. All right, let's get to our final interview of the night and close the show off. I Can See You is Graham Resnick's new film. And it's been called by none other than Nathan Lee in the New York Times. Or he has been heralded by Nathan Lee in the New York Times as a splendid new filmmaker with one eye on genre mechanics, one eye on avant-garde conceits, and a third eye for transcendental weirdness. So if that doesn't get you to buy this DVD, I don't know what will.
Yeah, I don't know what can help you people.
Ed Fangoria called it without a doubt one of the most intriguing and well-crafted low-budget horror films in recent memory. It's called I Can See You. It's available on DVD now. And also in this package, this DVD package, it includes an all-new 3D short film called The Viewer from Graham Resnick. And he's taking The Viewer and basing a feature film that he's calling The Teleport in 3D as well that he's currently producing. So this conversation that we have with Graham, he discusses I Can See You, and he discusses his foray into 3D and how accessible that is as a form for the independent filmmaker. Here's Graham Resnick. Why don't we start by... Here's Graham Resnick again. Why don't we start by telling me a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and how your consciousness of film started.
I grew up in Greenville, Delaware, which is about as boring as it sounds. I didn't have access to the entertainment industry, but I did just kind of enjoy movies like I think any kid did growing up. But I had one small thing that kind of connected me to movies in a way that always made me feel like I should pay more attention to it, and that was my grandfather was in films, and he unfortunately passed away before I really got to talk to him about it more, you know, like in depth. But he was in a movie with Tom Hanks in the 80s, and he was in a movie with Frank Sinatra in the 60s, and just kind of knowing those things always kind of steered me towards looking into movies as a way to go.
What movie did he do with Hanks?
He was in Punchline, which was where Tom Hanks plays a comedian. Yeah, he plays
and Sally Field. Yeah.
Yeah, he plays the old comedian who is kind of afraid to go on, and Tom Hanks has to use his powers, because Tom Hanks is a medical student who leaves the medical school to be a comedian, and he's got to then use his powers of medicine to convince my grandfather to go on.
I completely know the exact role you're talking about.
Funny.
I can see him in my mind. I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, Mac Robbins. That was my grandfather.
Wow. So when did you start taking it seriously as kind of appreciating films as an art form?
Well, it's interesting, and this sort of ties into the overall theme of the kind of stuff that I do, but I always kind of knew that there are all these different avenues of art forms, and they could be big and commercial, and then they could be small and personal. Mm-hmm. And big and commercial, small and personal, and then movies didn't fit into that. It was just big movies. I just only knew big movies, and I loved them. I still love big movies. But I did not know that you could do them as someone who didn't have tons of money or didn't have a studio behind you or didn't have, you know, armies of people to do your bidding. I thought it was just something that could only be done that way. And I think it was probably when I was a teenager and starting to discover independent film in the mid-late 90s, which was kind of a, you know, huge surge for independent film, that I realized that was actually possible.
Mm. So, you have very versatile tastes, I'm sure, in films. But was there a particular filmmaker or type of film that you latched onto and you kind of felt that you identified with more than any other?
Yeah, I think David Lynch is probably the best touchstone for what brought me into film directly. I've always been interested in art, and I've always been interested in the surreal and sort of the abnormal and science fiction, Philip K. Dick and that kind of thing. And discovering Twin Peaks when I was 13 or 14, about 2 years after it aired, I always knew what it was around. But I didn't – the experience of knowing that it was this big, popular thing that everyone was into, and then going and watching it and realizing how strange and deep and surreal it really was kind of a mind-blowing experience. The fact that people could be interested in that kind of thing.
You know, and you do everything. I mean, you write, you direct, you produce, you edit, you act, and you also have extensive experience as a sound designer and sound editor, and which makes perfect sense with the Lynch influence, because the sound plays such an important role in building that atmosphere in Lynch's work.
Yeah, it's almost a sleight of hand. I've always thought that visuals are, in some ways, the pretty distraction to allowing the sound to tweak your emotions while you're not looking. And mm-hmm. And I feel like Lynch does that very well. He'll just completely captivate you with an image, and then he'll reach in through sound and rip out your heart. And
exactly.
When you're not paying attention.
So is that how you, when you moved to L.A., I take it you moved to L.A. or?
I actually didn't. I'm in L.A. currently for the screening, but I'm based in Brooklyn. I live in Greenpoint, and I went to NYU, and I just kind of stayed there. So
when you started working in independent film, did you start on the sound end of it?
Yes and no. I went to NYU for directing, along with a friend of mine that I grew up with, Ty West. He went to SVA. I went to NYU.
Mm-hmm.
And, we're 15 blocks away from each other, and we were basically utilizing the resources of both schools as best we could, which was really a great way to do it, because there were times when you couldn't get stuff from one school or, couldn't get the resources from SVA or NYU, and we'd share. And then he was connected with Larry Fessenden, through a teacher of his, Kelly Reichardt at SVA, who's a mm-hmm. great filmmaker. And so I did a lot of short films at NYU, and I would work on his films. He would work on my films. Sometimes he would shoot my stuff. Sometimes I would sound design his stuff or shoot on his. And, he got the opportunity to do The Roost, his first feature film, right after college. And so he just asked me to do sound on it because he wanted to work with people that he knew. And I was also, very affordable at the time.
And you're still working with Larry. Larry's been on the show through his Glass Eye Picks, right? That's
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Your new films are under that banner, right?
That's right. Yeah, and I just listened to the interview with Joe Maggio, Bitter Feast, and all that. And those are the Hope crew. Those are the guys we work with all the time.
Tell me the benefit of kind of working in that family. I mean, because you guys have been together and collaborated for so long now, how does that benefit you as a filmmaker, do you think?
It's really nice because I know what people's strengths are, and to an extent we all know what each other's weaknesses are, so when things need to get done, the right people do them, and I think that streamlines our process.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've done together Glass Eye Picks since The Roost, or really The Off-Season, which was the first Scareflix film by Jim McKenney. It must be 12, 13 films? I'm not even sure, since 2005, 2004.
Wow.
And to an extent, there isn't one of the, none of those films have been like a completely separate crew. Like, there's been overlap for everything. Mm-hmm. And I've probably worked on, I don't know, maybe 9 or 10 of them.
Mm.
It's a really exciting experience to work with people who you respect and be able to rely on them over and over again and have them rely on you and build relationships with people, which I think I imagine that in the old studio system it was more like that, and I don't really know Hollywood that well. I don't know LA's film society that well, but from what I gather, it's a little bit more transient. People don't stick at one studio for their entire careers, or they're not as focused on following through the life of a film over 5-10 years.
Right.
They're interested in getting it made and getting it out there, which is completely reasonable, but because they're not staying at a company, it's not a long-term investment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with us, at least on the indie scale, we make these films and we want them to continue doing well, and I can see you as a good example. I shot that in 2006, and I'm still getting it out there in a way. It's been out there for a while, but it continues to grow and have a life of its own in a way that I think, if it came out through a different system, it would just kind of have an opening weekend and then go away.
Yeah. It really is a long journey with independent film.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a major investment. I want to ask you about writing. I Can See You, your new film. First question I had about the process of writing has to do with the other jobs, the other kind of filmmaking crew jobs that you've done, editing, sound design, acting. Do any of those benefit you as a writer, do you think, having that experience?
Well, I think specific to independent film, although this may be the case with more auteurish Hollywood films, but specific to independent film, you really have to know that what you're putting on the page you can do or you can have done for a very low cost. So I think it's very beneficial for any writer, director, and I think in independent film you get a lot of writer-directors who are doing both. You really need to just have experience or some small amount of mastery of specific things. Like I Can See You was written to my strengths of, you know, certain types of sound design and certain types of editing. I wouldn't have gone out and written a romantic comedy because I don't have experience in that, and I probably wouldn't have done a very good job, at least at that level. And I think most of the filmmakers that I know have a lot of experience doing all sorts of different things. They wear a lot of hats, either from film school or from working on each other's films in a community like Glass Eye Picks. But I think it's... Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. So when you sat down to write I Can See You, how much of it did you kind of preconceive before you sat down, and how much of it came from the actual process of pounding it out?
Well, now I'll just negate everything I just said. I preconceived it completely and then basically shot and created something else as we made it, because it was intended to be one story that was very concrete, but because of the realities of a production, I ended up splitting it up over long periods of time, and we shot a portion of it here, a portion of it there, when the actors were available, because the actors were just my friends who were other filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And they have careers, and the main guy, Ben Dickinson, he got an amazing opportunity to start directing music videos for The Rapture, who are, you know, a pretty popular indie rock band, and he really couldn't turn that down, and it coincided directly with the last few days of shooting. So we had to work around that, and because of that, it ended up allowing me to shoot a little bit and think about what I had done and think about how different what I shot was from what was on the page, and tweak my future plans to reflect the way that the story was naturally occurring in those, you know, fits and bursts of shooting, which my cinematographer, Gordon Arkenberg, is a big fan of Russian cinema, and I think he always talks about Tarkovsky kind of shooting that way, just deciding, you know what, I don't feel like we should shoot today. We should think about what we've done and go out later and, you know, shoot tomorrow.
Right.
And we'll be fresh and we'll have a better idea. But, I mean, you really can't get away with that in American shooting, I don't think.
Well, it is an odd thing, because I would think if you have a set schedule, you're shooting this film for 3 to 6 weeks, that's a very compact time and you guys are very intensive and in the zone.
Yeah.
But when you're shooting a little here, a little there, is there a danger of losing focus, or it just evolves over time?
I think there is a danger of losing focus if it happens over a very long period of time. What I realized about this film, I Can See You, was that because it dealt with a certain level of abstraction, as long as I kept the boundaries very focused, and my goals with where the film needed to go and sort of the language of and the motifs of the symbolism in the film very focused, then I had room to play and let things revolve and around those symbols and those boundaries and gravitate towards them, but kind of improvise with the actual specifics of the story.
Right. And so tell the audience a little bit about I Can See You and the idea that you're exploring there.
Well, I Can See You is about these three guys who get an opportunity to rebrand a window cleaning product. And they're a really young startup group in Brooklyn. And they're kind of naive, but they're really really eager. And they're not looking for money. They're just looking for experience. And in a sense, they're being taken advantage of, as many people are in that situation in that age. And one of them is already kind of on the brink of losing his grip because he's compromising his values so much. It's driving him a little batty. And when they get out to the woods to focus and to do this work, because a lot of it has to do with nature and the new direction for the campaign has to do with seeing nature more clearly through your windows because of the window cleaner. So they go out to the woods, and there's a love triangle, and a couple of the people disappear, and the main character, who's already losing it a little bit, just cannot process what's going on. And he begins to completely lose his grasp on reality.
When you showed this, because you just screened this for a film festival audience Friday the 13th, which is a great day. Had you had film festival coverage before?
This was actually not a festival. This was a single screening. But
I'm sorry.
But this film actually didn't really get into any festivals. We've done a run, and we did a run last year in New York. It's such a strange life for a film, but I think it's only fitting that such a strange film has had a strange run, and sort of slowly gathered, you know, a nice amount of success. But it did not get into very many festivals, and from what we've gathered from festival programmers, who all the ones that we've talked to at least seem to really love the film, it rides a fine line between being an indie genre, an indie drama experimental piece about these three guys who are, you know, having problems with their love life and with their jobs, and it's very existential, and then also becoming a straight up horror film.
Mm-hmm.
And programmers don't seem to be able to fit it into either of those categories, and they don't have a category for both. So it's,
right.
It's had a tough time with that. But,
yeah.
But critics seem to like it.
They really do. I mean, you're getting raves all over the place from the most reputable critics out there. But when you watched it with, you know, like this past Friday, when you watched it with that audience, what's it like to see your baby through their perspective?
Every time I see a film with an audience, it's a totally different and completely enlightening experience. I'm sure everyone says that, but it's absolutely true. It's if you ever, you know, get the chance to watch a film with an audience, I know some people just don't like to, but it's absolutely worthwhile because people laugh at different things and they gasp at different things, and it's always valuable for the next time around or even to continue to change and tweak things.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I think I've seen most conceivable audiences, and I'm not as surprised anymore, but you know, at what people react to. But it's always gratifying. It's always gratifying to see that what you did works.
Right, and the DVD, it includes I Can See You, and it also includes a 3D short film you did called The Viewer,
mm-hmm.
Which you're expanding upon now to develop into a feature film. You're calling The Teleport.
That's correct.
So tell me about the 3D, where your interest in 3D started, and what you think that gives to your creativity and your vision.
Oh, where did it start? It probably started when I was really young. I think I mentioned before that I've always loved movies, and I've always loved big movies. And when I was a kid, anything that was in 3D, a comic book, a movie, it just had this extra level of magic to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I always remember seeing illustrations in the comic book and thinking, the colors in that look a little bit off. What if I pull out these 3D glasses that I've had sitting around? You know, will it have an extra level of hidden meaning if I put them on and look at it? And it was such a thrill when you were right about that, and you put your glasses on, and the 3D just popped off the page. And and I was really excited to see a year or two ago that 3D was having a resurgence, and it looked like this time, you know, a good amount of money was being put into it, and there were a lot of very large films like Avatar that were on the horizon that indicated it would be taken a little more seriously this time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just decided I wanted to throw my hat in that ring and try something in 3D. I think it's a genre, and in the sense of being a genre, it's one that hasn't been mastered because it's never stuck around long enough to be explored to its fullest. So we don't have like The Shining of 3D. Like The Shining is a masterful horror film.
Mm-hmm.
I think everything that's coming out now is very good, but it'll take 10 years for people to even decide what are the masterpieces of 3D, and because of that, they're more open to new experiences.
And it's just now becoming, I think, it's just now kind of overcoming the people looking upon it as a gimmick. I think it all depends upon your material as well. But in bringing your vision to life with the viewer and the teleport, which you're doing now, how did you decide to utilize 3D? How did it work for you and what you're trying to accomplish?
Well, I've always been really, really interested in the idea of subjectivity. I've never been the type of guy who writes films from an omniscient perspective about multiple characters doing lots of different things and interweaving together. I enjoy those films and I enjoy those books, but it's never. I've always been really interested in seeing things from a very specific perspective, from one person's view of the world, because reality is all based completely on perspective, and reality is different for every person. So the most thrilling thing for me is to see another person's reality. It's like jumping into a different world. And I feel like TV now, if you make an equation, TV is kind of like novels, where TV can tell these long-form, beautifully interwoven stories from an omniscient perspective, and movies are now able to tell very, very interesting and in-depth subjective experiences, which really doesn't work quite as well on TV, I think, because it's a little more distracting with commercials and just with all the different things that make TV so great. It doesn't quite hold. But movies have this great opportunity now to really grab that that exploration of the subjective experience in the short form. And I think 3D is just another way to explore the reality of another, or the subjective experience of another person's reality. Because we'd be literally stepping into, we'd be stepping closer to the way that that subject sees the world.
Right. Is it, I would imagine the actual process of shooting it is very, very difficult.
I thought so too, and I when I explored this, about 2 years ago, I started doing some tests, and it turned out to be surprisingly simple. There's a lot of complex aspects to it when dealing with the files and the workflow and dealing with the post, but it's complex and it's not. It's really, when it comes down to it, you're just shooting something that replicates the left eye and replicates the right eye of the human vision. So you really just need to put two cameras next to each other in some form, and just be very careful about what you're shooting and how.
Wow. So tell me where you are with the teleport.
Well, the teleport is in sort of a middle stage right now. I've been developing it for a little over a year, and I've been working with GlassIPix, with Larry Fessenden, and with Peter Polk, who is a producer on most of the last batch of GlassEye films and a good friend of mine. And we've just been batting back and forth a beat sheet for a number of months, and then I've spent we spent about 6 months on that, and then I spent about 6 months on the script, and I'm just revising the second draft of that now, and I'm incredibly happy with it, and we're out there looking for financing and looking to be into production within the next year.
Do you storyboard at all?
I do. I have a short attention span for that kind of thing, so I tend to be a crazy shot lister, but I don't as much storyboard, but I do with stick figures and complex diagrams.
And I'm because I'm curious about how you frame a 3D film and how you choose to move the camera and where you place the elements within the frame, if that differs when you visualize a 3D movie as opposed to I Can See You.
It should. I think looking back now on what I did with the viewer, I am realizing that we did provide some indications of depth in our storyboards. The viewer was such a quick process. We, from conception to actually screening it in front of an audience, it was probably a month. So there are a lot of scribblings on napkins and back of matchbook kind of storyboards. It wasn't really the most proper way to go through with it. But with the teleport, we're probably going to be putting together actual pre-visualizations using like Maya and 3D programs, just to get a sense of the actual depth, because we're going to try to do a lot of play with depth and perspective.
So you, I mean, you're very unique because you're in the independent realm, and you're investing in the 3D technology to tell your stories.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think we're going to see a lot more of that? Do you think that 3D is here for a while now?
I hope so. I feel like there is a lot of skepticism or unease about it because, kind of like I was expressing my strangeness towards films when I was a kid, I didn't think that it was something I could do. I think that people still think it's something only big studios can do, and that's not for everybody. And I think that once people realize that the, you know, prosumer cameras that let you shoot 3D that are not any more expensive than, you know, your average prosumer HD camera, once they start coming down in price and 3D TVs start becoming a little more ubiquitous, I think we'll start seeing people experiment with it a lot more and a lot more readily. And once that happens, it'll be hopefully a little bit more accepted as an art form and not just an entertainment form. And that'll, right, that'll cement it, I think, even more fully.
I really think that it's really going to happen in a major way once these 3D TVs hit it big.
Yeah.
Once it becomes the norm, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I can see you and the viewer on DVD. They're available to purchase now?
Yeah, through Kino Video, and it's a nice little DVD package. It's got the viewer, and I Can See You, and a whole lot of other fun extras and Easter eggs. And Kino was kind enough to let me design most of the menus myself, so you get the whole experience, you know, from the time you pop the DVD in, you're in the world of I Can See You and the viewer.
Well, it's a great package, and they're great films. And tell me, when you get the teleport off the ground and you're ready to talk about that, I'd love to have you back on.
Yeah, I'd love to come on. Thank you for having me this time.
Okay, that's Graham Resnick. I Can See You is available on DVD now, also featuring the short 3D film he made called The Viewer.
Yeah,
complete with 3D glasses.
That was a great interview. That was really cool.
Thanks.
Hey, guys, I need to give a shout-out. We had a very important guest in the chat room, a very old friend of mine from right after high school, Dennis Martin, who's in the special effects business. Did like the Matrix movies, Evolution 2012, Speed Racer. There are a lot of special effects. He's not in the chat room right now, but he obviously tuned in for the James Cameron interview. And Dennis, thank you very much. That means the world to me. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Dennis. We thank everybody for being in the
chat
room.
Yes, everyone.
Good turnout tonight.
Yes.
And then thank you for listening on replay, if that's how you're listening to the interviews. The show tonight. Sunday night we'll be back with Last Exorcism star Patrick Fabian, fall movie preview next Wednesday, De Palma tribute series the following week, followed by a movie trivia night. So
musical Armageddon.
Hey, that's what we should call it.
You should definitely call it that.
Okay, speaking of music, let's get some closing music here. All I have are these De Palma music clips.
That's fine. Get everyone in the mood. Get them psyched up now.
So we did Pino for Blowout last show, when we closed last show. So let's do something different, a movie that is not among the five that we're paying tribute to, among De Palma's thrillers. This is
Wise Guys?
No.
I'm joking.
That was a thrilling movie. This is John Williams' score to The Fury.
Oh.
Yeah. Like a thriller that he didn't use Pino for.
Yeah, wow.
Ah. This is actually a favorite of film composers. I've heard film composers write and talk about this being one of those great uncovered kind of film scores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. No, I like it a lot.
All right, guys. Thank you. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you, and I will see you on Sunday.
All right, buddy.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.